multiple aphids on any one plant are genetically identical. However, there must be genes for the capacity to be environmentally switched into either of the two developmental pathways. Why has natural selection favored these genes, even though some of them end up in the bodies of sterile soldiers and are therefore never passed on? Because, thanks to the soldiers, copies of those very same genes have been saved in the bodies of the reproductive non-soldiers. The rationale is just the same as for all social insects, which we shall come to in Chapter 10, except that in other social insects, such as ants or termites, the genes in the sterile altruists have only a statistical chance of helping copies of themselves in non-sterile reproductives. Aphid altruistic genes enjoy certainty rather than statistical likelihood, since aphid soldiers are clone mates of the reproductive sisters whom they benefit. In some respects, Aoki's aphids provide the neatest real-life illustration of the power of Hamilton's ideas. Should aphids, then, be admitted to the exclusive club of truly social insects, traditionally the bastion of ants, bees, wasps, and termites? Entomological conservatives could blackball them on various grounds. They lack a long-lived old queen, for instance. Moreover, being a true clone, the aphids are no more social than the cells of your body. There is a single animal feeding on the plant. It just happens to have its body divided up into physically separate aphids, some of which play a specialized defensive role, just like white blood corpuscles in the human body. True social insects, the argument goes, cooperate in spite of not being part of the same organism, whereas Aoki's aphids cooperate because they do belong to the same organism. I cannot get worked up about this semantic issue. It seems to me that, so long as you understand what is going on among ants, aphids, and human cells, you should be at liberty to call them social or not as you please. As for my own preference, I have reasons for calling Aoki's aphids social organisms rather than parts of a single organism. There are crucial properties of a single organism which a single aphid possesses, but which a clone of aphids does not possess. The argument is spelled out in my book, The Extended Phenotype, in the chapter called Rediscovering the Organism, and also in the new chapter of the present book, Chapter 13, called The Long Reach of the Gene.
We can now see that parental care is just a special case of kin altruism. Genetically speaking, an adult should devote just as much care and attention to its orphaned baby brother as it does to one of its own children. Its relatedness to both infants is exactly the same, a half. In gene selection terms, a gene for big sister altruistic behavior should have just as good a chance of spreading through the population as a gene for parental altruism. In practice, this is an oversimplification for various reasons which we shall come to later, and brotherly or sisterly care is nothing like so common in nature as parental care. But the point we are making here is that there is nothing special, genetically speaking, about the parent-child relationship as against the brother-sister relationship. The fact that parents actually hand on genes to children, but sisters do not hand on genes to each other, is irrelevant, since the sisters both receive identical replicas of the same genes from the same parents. Some people use the term kin selection to distinguish this kind of natural selection from group selection, the differential survival of groups, and individual selection, the differential survival of individuals. Kin selection accounts for within-family altruism. The closer the relationship, the stronger the selection. There's nothing wrong with this term, but unfortunately, it may have to be abandoned because of recent gross misuses of it, which are likely to muddle and confuse biologists for years to come. E.O. Wilson, in his otherwise admirable sociobiology, The New Synthesis, defines kin selection as a special case of group selection. He has a diagram which clearly shows that he thinks of it as intermediate between individual selection and group selection in the conventional sense, the sense in which we used it in Chapter 1. Now, group selection, even by Wilson's own definition, means the differential survival of groups of individuals. There is, to be sure, a sense in which a family is a special kind of group, But the whole point of Hamilton's argument is that the distinction between family and non-family is not hard and fast, but a matter of mathematical probability. It is no part of Hamilton's theory that animals should behave altruistically towards all members of the family and selfishly to everybody else. There are no definite lines to be drawn between family and non-family. We do not have to decide whether, say, second cousins should count as inside the family group or outside it. We simply expect that second cousins should be 1/16th as likely to receive altruism as offspring or siblings. Kin selection is emphatically not a special case of group selection. It is a special consequence of gene selection.
Endnote. The confusion over the difference between group selection and kin selection has not disappeared. It may even have got worse. My remarks stand with redoubled emphasis, except that, by a thoughtless choice of words, I introduced a quite separate fallacy of my own in the first edition of this book. I said in the original, it is one of the few things I've altered in the text of this edition, we simply expect that second cousins should tend to receive 1/16th as much altruism as offspring or siblings. As S. Altman has pointed out, this is obviously wrong. It is wrong for a reason that has nothing to do with the point I was trying to argue at the time. If an altruistic animal has a cake to give to relatives, there is no reason at all for it to give every relative a slice, the size of the slices being determined by the closeness of relatedness. Indeed, this would lead to absurdity, since all members of the species, not to mention other species, are at least distant relatives who could therefore each claim a carefully measured crumb. On the contrary, if there is a close relative in the vicinity, there is no reason to give a distant relative any cake at all. Subject to other complications, like laws of diminishing returns, the whole cake should be given to the closest relative available. What I, of course, meant to say was, we simply expect that second cousins should be 1/16th as likely to receive altruism as offspring or siblings. And this is what now stands.
There is an even more serious shortcoming in Wilson's definition of kin selection. He deliberately excludes offspring. They don't count as kin. Now, of course, he knows perfectly well that offspring are kin to their parents, but he prefers not to invoke the theory of kin selection in order to explain altruistic care by parents of their own offspring. He is, of course, entitled to define a word however he likes, but this is a most confusing definition, and perhaps Wilson might like to change it in future editions of his justly influential book. Genetically speaking, parental care and brother-sister altruism evolve for exactly the same reason. In both cases, there is a good chance that the altruistic gene is present in the body of the beneficiary.
End note. I expressed the hope that Wilson would change his definition of kin selection in future writings so as to include offspring as kin. I am happy to report that in his book On Human Nature, the offending phrase, other than offspring, has indeed, I'm not claiming any credit for this, been omitted. He adds, although kin are defined so as to include offspring, the term kin selection is ordinarily used only if at least some other relatives, such as brothers, sisters, or parents, are also affected. This is unfortunately an accurate statement about ordinary usage by biologists, which simply reflects the fact that many biologists still lack a gut understanding of what kin selection is fundamentally all about. They still wrongly think of it as something extra and esoteric over and above ordinary individual selection. It isn't. Kin selection follows from the fundamental assumptions of neo-Darwinism as night follows day.
But we should return to the main story. We have so far oversimplified somewhat, and it's now time to introduce some qualifications. We have talked in elemental terms of suicidal genes for saving the lives of particular numbers of kin of exactly known relatedness. Obviously, in real life, animals cannot be expected to count exactly how many relatives they are saving, nor to perform Hamilton's calculations in their heads, even if they had some way of knowing exactly who their brothers and cousins were. In real life, certain suicide and absolute saving of life must be replaced by statistical risks of death, one's own and other people's. Even a third cousin may be worth saving if the risk to yourself is very small. Then again, both you and the relative you are thinking of saving are going to die one day in any case. Every individual has an expectation of life which an actuary could calculate with a certain probability of error. To save the life of a relative who is soon going to die of old age has less of an impact on the gene pool of the future than to save the life of an equally close relative who has the bulk of his life ahead of him. Our neat symmetrical calculations of relatedness have to be modified by messy actuarial weightings. Grandparents and grandchildren have, genetically speaking, equal reason to behave altruistically to each other since they share a quarter of each other's genes. But if the grandchildren have the greater expectation of life, genes for grandparent-to-grandchild altruism have a higher selective advantage than genes for grandchild-to-grandparent altruism. It is quite possible for the net benefit of assisting a young, distant relative to exceed the net benefit of assisting an old, close relative. Incidentally, it's not, of course, necessarily the case that grandparents have a shorter expectation of life than grandchildren. In species with a high infant mortality rate, the reverse may be true.
To extend the actuarial analogy, individuals can be thought of as life insurance underwriters. An individual can be expected to invest or risk a certain proportion of his own assets in the life of another individual. He takes into account his relatedness to the other individual and also whether the individual is a good risk in terms of his life expectancy compared with the insurer's own. Strictly, we should say reproduction expectancy rather than life expectancy, or to be even more strict, general capacity to benefit own genes in the future expectancy. Then, in order for altruistic behaviour to evolve, the net risk to the altruist must be less than the net benefit to the recipient multiplied by the relatedness. Risks and benefits have to be calculated in the complex actuarial way I have outlined. But what a complicated calculation to expect a poor survival machine to do, especially in a hurry. Even the great mathematical biologist J.B.S. Haldane, in a paper of 1955 in which he anticipated Hamilton by postulating the spread of a gene for saving close relatives from drowning, remarked, "On the two occasions when I have pulled possibly drowning people out of the water at an infinitesimal risk to myself, I had no time to make such calculations." Fortunately, however, as Haldane well knew, it is not necessary to assume that survival machines do the sums consciously in their heads, just as we may use a slide rule without appreciating that we are, in effect, using logarithms. So an animal may be pre-programmed in such a way that it behaves as if it had made a complicated calculation.
This is not so difficult to imagine as it appears. When a man throws a ball high in the air and catches it again, he behaves as if he had solved a set of differential equations in predicting the trajectory of the ball. He may neither know nor care what a differential equation is, but this does not affect his skill with the ball. At some subconscious level, something functionally equivalent to the mathematical calculations is going on. Similarly, when a man takes a difficult decision, after weighing up all the pros and cons and all the consequences of the decision that he can imagine, he is doing the functional equivalent of a large weighted sum calculation, such as a computer might perform.
End note. The fallacy that the theory of kin selection demands unrealistic feats of calculation by animals is revived without abatement by successive generations of students. Not just young students, either. The Use and Abuse of Biology, by the distinguished social anthropologist Marshall Sahlins, could be left in decent obscurity had it not been hailed as a withering attack on sociobiology. The following quotation, in the context of whether kin selection could work in humans, is almost too good to be true.
In passing, it needs to be remarked that the epistemological problems presented by a lack of linguistic support for calculating R, coefficients of relationship, amount to a serious defect in the theory of kin selection. Fractions are a very rare occurrence in the world's languages, appearing in Indo-European and in the archaic civilizations of the Near and Far East, but they're generally lacking among the so-called primitive peoples. Hunters and gatherers generally do not have counting systems beyond 1, 2, and 3. I refrain from comment on the even greater problem of how animals are supposed to figure out how R, in the case of ego and first cousins, equals 1/8.
This is not the first time I have quoted this highly revealing passage, and I may as well quote my own rather uncharitable reply to it in my paper, 12 Misunderstandings of Kin Selection. A pity for Sahlins that he succumbed to the temptation to refrain from comment on how animals are supposed to figure out R. The very absurdity of the idea he tried to ridicule should have set mental alarm bells ringing. A snail shell is an exquisite logarithmic spiral, but where does the snail keep its log tables? How indeed does it read them, since the lens in its eye lacks linguistic support for calculating M, the coefficient of refraction? How do green plants figure out the formula of chlorophyll? The fact is that if you thought about anatomy, physiology, almost any aspect of biology, not just behavior, in Sahlins's way, you would arrive at his same non-existent problem. The embryological development of any bit of an animal's or plant's body requires complicated mathematics for its complete description, but this does not mean that the animal or plant must itself be a clever mathematician. Very tall trees usually have huge buttresses flaring out like wings from the base of their trunks. Within any one species, the taller the tree, the relatively larger the buttresses. It is widely accepted that the shape and size of these buttresses are close to the economic optimum for keeping the tree erect, although an engineer would require quite sophisticated mathematics to demonstrate this. It would never occur to Sahlins or anyone else to doubt the theory underlying buttresses, simply on the grounds that trees lack the mathematical expertise to do the calculations. Why then raise the problem for the special case of kin-selected behavior? It can't be because it is behavior as opposed to anatomy, because there are plenty of other examples of behavior, other than kin-selected behavior, I mean, that Sahlins would cheerfully accept without raising his epistemological objection. Think, for instance, of my own illustration of the complicated calculations that in some sense we all must do whenever we catch a ball. One cannot help wondering, are there social scientists who are quite happy with the theory of natural selection generally, but who, for quite extraneous reasons that may have roots in the history of their subject, desperately want to find something, anything, wrong with the theory of kin selection specifically?
If we were to program a computer to simulate a model survival machine making decisions about whether to behave altruistically, we should probably proceed roughly as follows. We should make a list of all the alternative things the animal might do. Then, for each of these alternative behavior patterns, we program a weighted sum calculation. All the various benefits will have a plus sign. All the risks will have a minus sign. Both benefits and risks will be weighted by being multiplied by the appropriate index of relatedness before being added up. For simplicity, we can, to begin with, ignore other weightings, such as those for age and health. Since an individual's relatedness with himself is 1, i.e. he has 100% of his own genes, obviously, risks and benefits to himself will not be devalued at all, but will be given their full weight in the calculation. The whole sum for any one of the alternative behavior patterns will look like this. Net benefit of behavior pattern equals benefit to self minus risk to self plus half benefit to brother minus half risk to brother plus half benefit to other brother minus half risk to other brother plus 1/8 benefit to first cousin minus 1/8 risk to first cousin plus half benefit to child minus half risk to child, plus, etc. The result of the sum will be a number called the net benefit score of that behavior pattern. Next, the model animal computes the equivalent sum for each alternative behaviour pattern in his repertoire. Finally, he chooses to perform the behaviour pattern which emerges with the largest net benefit. Even if all the scores come out negative, he should still choose the action with the highest one, the least of evils. Remember that any positive action involves consumption of energy and time, both of which could have been spent doing other things. If doing nothing emerges as the behaviour with the highest net benefit score, the model animal will do nothing.
Here is a very oversimplified example, this time expressed in the form of a subjective soliloquy rather than a computer simulation. I am an animal who has found a clump of 8 mushrooms. After taking account of their nutritional value and subtracting something for the slight risk that they might be poisonous, I estimate that they are worth plus 6 units each. The units are arbitrary payoffs as in the previous chapter. The mushrooms are so big I could eat only 3 of them. Should I inform anybody else about my find by giving a food call? Who is within earshot? Brother B, his relatedness to me is a half, cousin C, relatedness to me equals 1/8, and D, no particular relation. His relatedness to me is some small number which can be treated as 0 for practical purposes. The net benefit score to me if I keep quiet about my find will be plus 6 for each of the 3 mushrooms I eat, that is plus 18 in all. My benefit score if I give the food call needs a bit of figuring. The 8 mushrooms will be shared equally between the 4 of us. The payoff to me from the 2 that I eat myself will be the full plus 6 units each, that is plus 12 in all. But I shall also get some payoff when my brother and cousin eat their 2 mushrooms each, because of our shared genes. The actual score comes to 1 times 12 plus a half times 12 plus an eighth times 12 plus 0 times 12 equals plus 19 and a half. The corresponding net benefit score for the selfish behaviour was plus 18. It is a close-run thing, but the verdict is clear. I should give the food call. Altruism on my part would in this case pay my selfish genes. I have made the simplifying assumption that the individual animal works out what is best for his genes. What really happens is that the gene pool becomes filled with genes that influence bodies in such a way that they behave as if they made such calculations. In any case, the calculation is only a very preliminary first approximation to what it ideally should be. It neglects many things, including the ages of the individuals concerned. Also, if I have just had a good meal so that I can only find room for 1 mushroom, the net benefit of giving the food call will be greater than it would be if I was famished. There is no end to the progressive refinements of the calculation that could be achieved in the best of all possible worlds. But real life is not lived in the best of all possible worlds. We cannot expect real animals to take every last detail into account in coming to an optimum decision. We shall have to discover, by observation and experiment in the wild, how closely real animals actually come to achieving an ideal cost-benefit analysis.
Just to reassure ourselves that we've not become too carried away with subjective examples, let us briefly return to gene language. Living bodies are machines programmed by genes that have survived. The genes that have survived have done so in conditions that tended, on average, to characterize the environment of the species in the past. Therefore, estimates of costs and benefits are based on past experience, just as they are in human decision-making. However, experience in this case has the special meaning of gene experience, or more precisely, conditions of past gene survival. Since genes also endow survival machines with the capacity to learn, some cost-benefit estimates could be said to be taken on the basis of individual experience as well. So long as conditions do not change too drastically, the estimates will be good estimates, and survival machines will tend to make the right decisions on average. If conditions change radically, survival machines will tend to make erroneous decisions, and their genes will pay the penalty. Just so, human decisions based on outdated information tend to be wrong. Estimates of relatedness are also subject to error and uncertainty. In our oversimplified calculations so far, we have talked as if survival machines know who is related to them and how closely. In real life, such certain knowledge is occasionally possible, but more usually the relatedness can only be estimated as an average number. For example, suppose that A and B could equally well be either half-brothers or full-brothers. Their relatedness is either a quarter or a half, but since we do not know whether they are half or full brothers, the effectively usable figure is the average 3/8. If it is certain that they have the same mother, but the odds that they have the same father are only 1 in 10, then it is 90% certain that they are half-brothers and 10% certain that they are full-brothers, and the effective relatedness is 1/10 times a half plus 9/10 times a quarter equals 0.275. But when we say something like, it is 90% certain, what it are we referring to? Do we mean a human naturalist after a long field study is 90% certain? Or do we mean the animals are 90% certain? With a bit of luck, these two may amount to nearly the same thing. To see this, we have to think how animals might actually go about estimating who their close relations are. We know who our relations are because we are told, because we give them names, because we have formal marriages, and because we have written records and good memories.
End note. The whole subject of kin recognition has taken off in a big way since this book was written. Animals, including ourselves, seem to show remarkably subtle abilities to discriminate relatives from non-relatives, often by smell. A recent book, Kin Recognition in Animals, summarizes what is known. The chapter on humans by Pamela Wells shows that the statement above, we know who our relations are because we are told, needs to be supplemented. There is at least circumstantial evidence that we are capable of using various non-verbal cues, including the smell of our relative's sweat. The whole subject is for me epitomized by the quotation with which she begins.
All good comrades you can tell by their altruistic smell. E.E. Cummings.
Relatives might need to recognize one another for reasons other than altruism. They might also want to strike a balance between outbreeding and inbreeding, as we shall see shortly. Back to the main text.
Many social anthropologists are preoccupied with kinship in the societies which they study. They do not mean real genetic kinship, but subjective and cultural ideas of kinship. Human customs and tribal rituals commonly give great emphasis to kinship. Ancestor worship is widespread, family obligations and loyalties dominate much of life. Blood feuds and inter-clan warfare are easily interpretable in terms of Hamilton's genetic theory. Incest taboos testify to the great kinship consciousness of man, although the genetical advantage of an incest taboo is nothing to do with altruism. It is presumably concerned with the injurious effects of recessive genes which appear with inbreeding. For some reason, many anthropologists do not like this explanation.
End note. A lethal gene is one that kills its possessor. A recessive lethal, like any recessive gene, doesn't exert its effect unless it is in double dose. Recessive lethals get by in the gene pool because most individuals possessing them have only one copy and therefore never suffer the effects. Any given lethal is rare because if it ever gets common, it meets copies of itself and kills off its carriers. There could nevertheless be lots of different types of lethal, so we could still all be riddled with them. Estimates vary as to how many different ones there are lurking in the human gene pool. Some books reckon as many as 2 lethals on average per person. If a random male mates with a random female, the chances are that his lethals will not match hers, and their children will not suffer. But if a brother mates with a sister, or a father with a daughter, things are ominously different. However rare my lethal recessives may be in the population at large, and however rare my sister's lethal recessives may be in the population at large, there is a disquietingly high chance that hers and mine are the same. If you do the sums, it turns out that for every lethal recessive that I possess, if I mate with my sister, 1 in 8 of our offspring will be born dead, or will die young. Incidentally, dying in adolescence is even more lethal, genetically speaking, than dying at birth. A stillborn child doesn't waste so much of the parent's vital time and energy. But whichever way you look at it, close incest is not just mildly deleterious, it is potentially catastrophic. Selection for active incest avoidance could be as strong as any selection pressure that has been measured in nature. Anthropologists who object to Darwinian explanations of incest avoidance perhaps do not realize what a strong Darwinian case they are opposing. Their arguments are sometimes so weak as to suggest desperate special pleading. They commonly say, for instance,
"If Darwinian selection had really built into us an instinctive revulsion against incest, we wouldn't need to forbid it. The taboo only grows up because people have incestuous lusts. So the rule against incest cannot have a biological function, it must be purely social."
This objection is rather like the following:
"Cars don't need locks on the ignition switch because they have locks on the doors. Therefore, ignition locks cannot be anti-theft devices. They must have some purely ritual significance."
Anthropologists are also fond of stressing that different cultures have different taboos, indeed, different definitions of kinship. They seem to think that this, too, undermines Darwinian aspirations to explain incest avoidance. But one might as well say that sexual desire cannot be a Darwinian adaptation, because different cultures prefer to copulate in different positions. It seems to me highly plausible that incest avoidance in humans, no less than in other animals, is the consequence of strong Darwinian selection. Not only is it a bad thing to mate with those genetically too close to you, too distant outbreeding can also be bad because of genetic incompatibilities between different strains. Exactly where the ideal intermediate falls is not easy to predict. Should you mate with your first cousin, with your second or third cousin? Patrick Bateson has tried to ask Japanese quail where their own preferences lie along the spectrum. In an experimental setup called the Amsterdam apparatus, birds were invited to choose among members of the opposite sex arrayed behind miniature shop windows. They preferred first cousins over both full siblings and unrelated birds. Further experiments suggested that young quail learn the attributes of their clutch companions and then, later in life, tend to choose sexual partners that are quite like their clutch mates, but not too like them. Quail, then, seem to avoid incest by their own internal lack of desire for those with whom they have grown up. Other animals do it by observing social laws, socially imposed rules of dispersal. Adolescent male lions, for instance, are driven out of the parental pride where female relatives remain to tempt them, and breed only if they manage to usurp another pride. In chimpanzee and gorilla societies, it tends to be the young females who leave to seek mates in other bands. Both dispersal patterns, as well as the quail system, are to be found among the various cultures of our own species.
How could wild animals know who their kin are? Or in other words, what behavioural rules could they follow which would have the indirect effect of making them seem to know about kinship? The rule, "be nice to your relations," begs the question of how relations are to be recognised in practice. Animals have to be given, by their genes, a simple rule for action, a rule that does not involve all-wise cognition of the ultimate purpose of the action, but a rule that works, nevertheless, at least in average conditions. We humans are familiar with rules, and so powerful are they, that if we are small-minded, we obey a rule itself, even when we can see perfectly well that it's not doing us or anybody else any good. For instance, some Orthodox Jews and Muslims would starve rather than break their rule against eating pork. What simple practical rules could animals obey which, under normal conditions, would have the indirect effect of benefiting their close relations? If animals had a tendency to behave altruistically towards individuals who physically resembled them, they might indirectly be doing their kin a bit of good. Much would depend on details of the species concerned. Such a rule would, in any case, only lead to right decisions in a statistical sense. If conditions changed, for example, if a species started living in much larger groups, it could lead to wrong decisions. Conceivably, racial prejudice could be interpreted as an irrational generalization of a kin-selected tendency to identify with individuals physically resembling oneself and to be nasty to individuals different in appearance.
In a species whose members do not move around much, or whose members move around in small groups, the chances may be good that any random individual you come across is fairly close kin to you. In this case, the rule, be nice to any member of the species whom you meet, could have positive survival value in the sense that a gene predisposing its possessors to obey the rule might become more numerous in the gene pool. This may be why altruistic behavior is so frequently reported in troops of monkeys and schools of whales. Whales and dolphins drown if they are not allowed to breathe air. Baby whales and injured individuals who cannot swim to the surface have been seen to be rescued and held up by companions in the school. It is not known whether whales have ways of knowing who their close relatives are, but it is possible that it does not matter. It may be that the overall probability that a random member of the school is a relation is so high that the altruism is worth the cost. Incidentally, there is at least one well-authenticated story of a drowning human swimmer being rescued by a wild dolphin. This could be regarded as a misfiring of the rule for saving drowning members of the school. The rule's definition of a member of the school who is drowning might be something like a long thing thrashing about and choking near the surface. Adult male baboons have been reported to risk their lives defending the rest of the troop against predators such as leopards. It is quite probable that any adult male has, on average, a fairly large number of genes tied up in other members of the troop. A gene that says, in effect, "Body, if you happen to be an adult male, defend the troop against leopards," could become more numerous in the gene pool. Before leaving this often quoted example, it's only fair to add that at least one respected authority has reported very different facts. According to her, adult males are the first over the horizon when a leopard appears.
Baby chicks feed in family clutches, all following their mother. They have two main calls. In addition to the loud, piercing cheep, which we've already mentioned, they give short, melodious twitters when feeding. The cheeps, which have the effect of summoning the mother's aid, are ignored by the other chicks. The twitters, however, are attractive to chicks. This means that when one chick finds food, its twitters attract other chicks to the food as well. In terms of the earlier hypothetical example, the twitters are food calls. As in that case, the apparent altruism of the chicks can easily be explained by kin selection. Since, in nature, the chicks would be all full brothers and sisters, a gene for giving the food twitter would spread, provided the cost to the twitterer is less than half the net benefit to the other chicks. As the benefit is shared out between the whole clutch, which normally numbers more than two, it's not difficult to imagine this condition being realized. Of course, the rule misfires in domestic or farm situations when a hen is made to sit on eggs not her own, even turkey or duck eggs. But neither the hen nor her chicks can be expected to realize this. Their behavior has been shaped under the conditions that normally prevail in nature, and in nature, strangers are not normally found in your nest. Mistakes of this sort may, however, occasionally happen in nature. In species that live in herds or troops, an orphaned youngster may be adopted by a strange female, most probably one who has lost her own child. Monkey watchers sometimes use the word aunt for an adopting female. In most cases, there's no evidence that she really is an aunt, or indeed any kind of relative. If monkey watchers were as gene-conscious as they might be, they would not use an important word like aunt so uncritically. In most cases, we should probably regard adoption, however touching it may seem, as a misfiring of a built-in rule. This is because the generous female is doing her own genes no good by caring for the orphan. She is wasting time and energy which she could be investing in the lives of her own kin, particularly future children of her own. It's presumably a mistake that happens too seldom for natural selection to have bothered to change the rule by making the maternal instinct more selective. In many cases, by the way, such adoptions do not occur, and an orphan is left to die.
There is one example of a mistake which is so extreme that you may prefer to regard it not as a mistake at all, but as evidence against the selfish gene theory. This is the case of bereaved monkey mothers who have been seen to steal a baby from another female and look after it. I see this as a double mistake, since the adopter not only wastes her own time, she also releases a rival female from the burden of child-rearing, and frees her to have another child more quickly. It seems to me a critical example which deserves some thorough research. We need to know how often it happens, what the average relatedness between adopter and child is likely to be, and what the attitude of the real mother of the child is. It is, after all, to her advantage that her child should be adopted. Do mothers deliberately try to deceive young females into adopting their children? It has also been suggested that adopters and baby snatchers might benefit by gaining valuable practice in the art of child-rearing. An example of a deliberately engineered misfiring of the maternal instinct is provided by cuckoos and other brood parasites, birds that lay their eggs in somebody else's nest. Cuckoos exploit the rule built into bird parents. Be nice to any small bird sitting in the nest that you built. Cuckoos apart, this rule will normally have the desired effect of restricting altruism to immediate kin, because it happens to be a fact that nests are so isolated from each other that the contents of your own nest are almost bound to be your own chicks. Adult herring gulls do not recognize their own eggs and will happily sit on other gull eggs and even crude wooden dummies if these are substituted by a human experimenter. In nature, egg recognition is not important for gulls because eggs do not roll far enough to reach the vicinity of a neighbor's nest, some yards away. Gulls do, however, recognize their own chicks. Chicks, unlike eggs, wander and can easily end up near the nest of a neighboring adult, often with fatal results, as we saw in Chapter 1.
Guillemots, on the other hand, do recognize their own eggs by means of the speckling pattern and actively discriminate in favor of them when incubating. This is presumably because they nest on flat rocks where there is a danger of eggs rolling around and getting muddled up. Now, it might be said, why do they bother to discriminate and sit only on their own eggs? Surely if everybody saw to it that she sat on somebody's egg, it would not matter whether each particular mother was sitting on her own or somebody else's. This is the argument of a group selectionist. Just consider what would happen if such a group babysitting circle did develop. The average clutch size of the guillemot is one. This means that if the mutual babysitting circle is to work successfully, every adult would have to sit on an average of one egg. Now suppose somebody cheated and refused to sit on an egg. Instead of wasting time sitting, she could spend her time laying more eggs. And the beauty of the scheme is that the other, more altruistic adults would look after them for her. They would go on faithfully obeying the rule, if you see a stray egg near your nest, haul it in and sit on it. So the gene for cheating the system would spread through the population and the nice, friendly babysitting circle would break down. Well, it might be said, what if the honest birds retaliated by refusing to be blackmailed and resolutely decided to sit on one egg and only one egg? That should foil the cheaters, because they would see their own eggs lying out on the rocks with nobody incubating them. That should soon bring them into line. Alas, it would not. Since we are postulating that the sitters are not discriminating one egg from another, if the honest birds put into practice this scheme for resisting cheating, the eggs that ended up being neglected would be just as likely to be their own eggs as those of the cheaters. The cheaters would still have the advantage, because they would lay more eggs and have more surviving children. The only way an honest guillemot could beat the cheaters would be to discriminate actively in favour of her own eggs. That is, to cease being altruistic and look after her own interests. To use the language of Maynard Smith, the altruistic adoption strategy is not an evolutionarily stable strategy. It is unstable in the sense that it can be bettered by a rival selfish strategy of laying more than one's fair share of eggs and then refusing to sit on them. This latter selfish strategy is in its turn unstable because the altruistic strategy which it exploits is unstable and will disappear. The only evolutionarily stable strategy for a guillemot is to recognize its own egg and sit exclusively on its own egg, and that is exactly what happens. The songbird species that are parasitized by cuckoos have fought back, not in this case by learning the appearance of their own eggs, but by discriminating instinctively in favor of eggs with the species' typical markings. Since they are not in danger of being parasitized by members of their own species, this is effective. But the cuckoos have retaliated in their turn by making their eggs more and more like those of the host species in color, size, and markings. This is an example of a lie, and it often works. The result of this evolutionary arms race has been a remarkable perfection of mimicry on the part of the cuckoo eggs. We may suppose that a proportion of cuckoo eggs and chicks are found out, but those that are not found out are the ones who live to lay the next generation of cuckoo eggs. So genes for more effective deception spread through the cuckoo gene pool. Similarly, those host birds with eyes sharp enough to detect any slight imperfection in the cuckoo egg's mimicry are the ones that contribute most to their own gene pool. Thus, sharp and skeptical eyes are passed on to their next generation. This is a good example of how natural selection can sharpen up active discrimination, in this case discrimination against another species whose members are doing their best to foil the discriminators.
End note. It is probably true that most species of birds do not parasitize the nests of their own species. Nevertheless, we should not be surprised to find some birds doing so. And the phenomenon is indeed being found in an increasing number of species. This is especially so now that new molecular techniques are coming in for establishing who is related to whom. Actually, the selfish gene theory might expect it to happen even more often than we so far know.
Now let us return to the comparison between an animal's estimate of its kinship with other members of its group and the corresponding estimate of an expert field naturalist. Brian Bertram has spent many years studying the biology of lions in the Serengeti National Park. On the basis of his knowledge of their reproductive habits, he has estimated the average relatedness between individuals in a typical lion pride. The facts that he uses to make his estimates are things like this. A typical pride consists of 7 adult females who are its more permanent members and 2 adult males who are itinerant. About half the adult females give birth as a batch at the same time and rear their cubs together so that it is difficult to tell which cub belongs to whom. The typical litter size is 3 cubs. The fathering of litters is shared equally between the adult males in the pride. Young females remain in the pride and replace old females who die or leave. Young males are driven out when adolescent. When they grow up, they wander around from pride to pride in small related gangs or pairs and are unlikely to return to their original family. Using these and other assumptions, you can see that it would be possible to compute an average figure for the relatedness of 2 individuals from a typical lion pride. Bertram arrives at a figure of 0.22 for a pair of randomly chosen males and 0.15 for a pair of females. That is to say, males within a pride are on average slightly less close than half-brothers and females slightly closer than first cousins. Now, of course, any particular pair of individuals might be full brothers, but Bertram had no way of knowing this, and it's a fair bet that the lions did not know it either. On the other hand, the average figures that Bertram estimated are available to the lions themselves in a certain sense. If these figures really are typical for an average lion pride, then any gene that predisposed males to behave towards other males as if they were nearly half-brothers would have positive survival value. Any gene that went too far and made males behave in a friendly way more appropriate to full brothers would on average be penalised, as would a gene for not being friendly enough, say treating other males like second cousins. If the facts of lion life are as Bertram says, and just as important, if they have been like that for a large number of generations, then we may expect that natural selection will have favoured a degree of altruism appropriate to the average degree of relatedness in a typical pride. This is what we mean when we say that the kinship estimates of animal and of good naturalist might end up rather the same.
End note. Bertram's emphasis on kin selection as the primary mover of cooperation in lions has been challenged by C. Packer and A. Pusey. They claim that in many prides the two male lions are not related. Packer and Pusey suggest that reciprocal altruism is at least as likely as kin selection as an explanation for cooperation in lions. Probably both sides are right. Chapter 12 of this book emphasizes that reciprocation, tit for tat, can evolve only if a critical quorum of reciprocators can initially be mustered. This ensures that a would-be partner has a decent chance of being a reciprocator. Kinship is perhaps the most obvious way for this to happen. Relatives naturally tend to resemble one another, so even if the critical frequency is not met in the population at large, it may be met within the family. Perhaps cooperation in lions got its start through the kin effect suggested by Bertram, and this provided the necessary conditions for reciprocation to be favoured. The disagreement over lions can be settled only by facts, and facts, as ever, tell us only about the particular case, not the general theoretical argument.
So we conclude that the true relatedness may be less important in the evolution of altruism than the best estimate of relatedness that animals can get. This fact is probably a key to understanding why parental care is so much more common and more devoted than brother-sister altruism in nature, and also why animals may value themselves more highly even than several brothers. Briefly, what we are saying is that in addition to the index of relatedness, we should consider something like an index of certainty. Although the parent-child relationship is no closer genetically than the brother-sister relationship, its certainty is greater. It is normally possible to be much more certain who your children are than who your brothers are, and you can be more certain still who you yourself are. We considered cheaters among the guillemots, and we shall have more to say about liars and cheaters and exploiters in following chapters. In a world where other individuals are constantly on the alert for opportunities to exploit kin-selected altruism and use it for their own ends, a survival machine has to consider who it can trust, who it can be really sure of. If B is really my baby brother, then I should care for him up to half as much as I care for myself and fully as much as I care for my own child. But can I be as sure of him as I can of my own child? How do I know he is my baby brother? If C is my identical twin, then I should care for him twice as much as I care for any of my children. Indeed, I should value his life no less than my own. But can I be sure of him? He looks like me, to be sure, but it could be that we just happen to share the genes for facial features. No, I will not give up my life for him, because although it is possible that he bears 100% of my genes, I absolutely know that I contain 100% of my genes, so I am worth more to me than he is. I am the only individual that any one of my selfish genes can be sure of. And although ideally a gene for individual selfishness would be displaced by a rival gene for altruistically saving at least one identical twin, two children, or brothers, or at least four grandchildren, etc., the gene for individual selfishness has the enormous advantage of certainty of individual identity. The rival kin altruistic gene runs the risk of making mistakes of identity, either genuinely accidental or deliberately engineered by cheats and parasites. We therefore must expect individual selfishness in nature to an extent greater than would be predicted by considerations of genetic relatedness alone.
End note. It is now widely understood that an identical twin is theoretically as valuable to you as you are to yourself, as long as the twin really is guaranteed identical. What is not so widely understood is that the same is true of a guaranteed monogamous mother. If you know for certain that your mother will continue to produce your father's children, and only your father's children, your mother is as genetically valuable to you as an identical twin, or as yourself. Think of yourself as an offspring-producing machine. Then your monogamous mother is a full-sibling-producing machine, and full siblings are as genetically valuable to you as your own offspring. Of course, this neglects all kinds of practical considerations. For instance, your mother is older than you, though whether this makes her a better or worse bet for future reproduction than you yourself depends on particular circumstances. We can't give a general rule. That argument assumes that your mother can be relied upon to continue producing your father's children, as opposed to some other male's children. The extent to which she can be relied upon depends upon the mating system of the species. If you are a member of a habitually promiscuous species, you obviously cannot count on your mother's offspring being your full siblings. Even under ideally monogamous conditions, there is one apparently inescapable consideration that tends to make your mother a worse bet than you are yourself. Your father may die. With the best will in the world, if your father is dead, your mother can hardly be expected to go on producing his children, can she? Well, as a matter of fact, she can. The circumstances under which this can happen are obviously of great interest for the theory of kin selection. As mammals, we are used to the idea that birth follows copulation after a fixed and rather short interval. A human male can father young posthumously, but not after he has been dead longer than 9 months, except with the aid of deep freezing in a sperm bank. But there are several groups of insects in which a female stores sperm inside herself for the whole of her life, eking it out to fertilize eggs as the years go by, often long years after the death of her mate. If you are a member of a species that does this, you can potentially be really very sure that your mother will continue to be a good genetic bet. A female ant mates only in a single mating flight early in her life. The female then loses her wings and never mates again. Admittedly, in many ant species, the female mates with several males on her mating flight. But if you happen to belong to one of those species whose females are always monogamous, you really can regard your mother as at least as good a genetic bet as you are yourself. The great point about being a young ant, as opposed to a young mammal, is that it doesn't matter whether your father is dead. Indeed, he almost certainly is dead. You can be pretty sure that your father's sperm are living on after him, and that your mother can continue to make full siblings for you. It follows that, if we are interested in the evolutionary origins of sibling care, and a phenomena like the insect soldiers, we should look with special attention towards those species in which females store sperm for life. In the case of ants, bees and wasps, there is, as Chapter 10 discusses, a special genetic peculiarity, haplodiploidy, that may have predisposed them to become highly social. What I'm arguing here is that haplodiploidy is not the only predisposing factor. The habit of lifetime sperm storage may have been at least as important. Under ideal conditions, it can make a mother as genetically valuable and as worthy of altruistic help as an identical twin.
In many species, a mother can be more sure of her young than a father can. The mother lays the visible, tangible egg or bears the child. She has a good chance of knowing for certain the bearers of her own genes. The poor father is much more vulnerable to deception. It is therefore to be expected that fathers will put less effort than mothers into caring for young. We shall see that there are other reasons to expect the same thing in the chapter on the Battle of the Sexes, Chapter 9. Similarly, maternal grandmothers can be more sure of their grandchildren than paternal grandmothers can, and might be expected to show more altruism than paternal grandmothers. This is because they can be sure of their daughter's children, but their son may have been cuckolded. Maternal grandfathers are just as sure of their grandchildren as paternal grandmothers are, since both can reckon on one generation of certainty and one generation of uncertainty. Similarly, uncles on the mother's side should be more interested in the welfare of nephews and nieces than uncles on the father's side, and in general should be just as altruistic as aunts are. Indeed, in a society with a